This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you for selecting the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. Today, with Helen Needham and Ewan McElraith, and we've got some really eerie stuff this morning that will fascinate you. It certainly fascinated us. And we'll be trying our hand at dowsing. Good morning, I'm Ewan McElraith, and I left Bonnie Bamshire this morning, bright and early, to come into the BBC car park for the first time in a very long time. With me this morning is Helen Needham.
Hello, we're very keen to hear what you're up to this weekend. It's an absolutely beautiful morning here in Aberdeen. It feels like we're heading towards high summer. It's just my most favourite time of the year. In fact, it's such an exciting time of year. I'm actually finding it quite difficult to go to sleep at night because there's so much light. The forecast looks favourable in this neck of the woods, certainly. You can email us, tell us what you're up to, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295, your standard network message rate applies, and you can call Finlay as well on 08085 92 95 00. And we've had a piece of correspondence already. Wow. And this is from Colin and Mary Abercrombie, who normally live in Dunblane, and they're saying, morning gents, well sorry, Mark's on his halls, we're up in Shieldaig watching the start of the Keltman. The first swimmer came in at 5:40. Yeah. The wind is freshening, so the cycle will be tough. Best wishes to all the competitors and support crews. Well, that's one crazy event, isn't it? You have to be super fit for that.
I feel like 2 minutes into the programme and feel inadequate already. Coming up, we've got the last seagoing paddle steamer in the country. It's getting ready to set sail again. We've got the latest news on the Waverley. And you've been out and about on Deeside.
Well, yes, I recorded this a couple of weeks ago. I went out to near Tarland to the Tom Naviri Stone Circle with the fiddler and composer Paul Anderson. And he was telling me about a particular experience he had with dowsing. So we're going to be looking at that a bit later on. But first, we couldn't have you here without a mystery bird, courtesy of Ewan, which is sure to confuse and enlighten in equal measure. Have a listen to this. Do you know what bird makes that sound? You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, and you can call as well on 08085 92 95 00.
It's kind of like a chicken galloping through the courtyard.
You mean the sound or the actual bird?
Yeah, the sound, that kind of glue. Sorry.
Yes.
Anyway, the concrete last week was far too easy. We got hundreds of entries and blew the printed apart. Anyway, Ian Wright got in touch with his memories of the bird, and he says, following last Saturday's programme, when you mentioned some sources that doubted the existence of the corncrake in northeast Scotland, I recall in 1978, as a mature undergraduate zoology student at St Andrews University, and a field trip to Betty Hill in Sutherland.
I vividly recall nights of disturbed sleep due to the melodious, and that's, yeah, that's an inverted comma, call of the corncrake. I'd never heard it before, but it was so distinctive. Also, there were numerous lizards on a raised beach at 300 feet and considered alpine between Betty Hill and Tongue. My wife and I are regular listeners to your informative and entertaining, thank you very much, programme, setting the alarm for 6:30 on Saturdays as opposed to 7 a.m. for the rest of the week.
Well, that's high praise indeed, Ian. Thank you very much. Now, this is a time of year when thousands of seabirds are nesting on the cliffs around our shores. A couple of weekends ago, I was up at Troop Head, the RSPB Nature Reserve, and it is fantastic. It's a couple of miles from Banff. And Mark went up there recently and just by chance met in with the RSPB site manager, Richard Humpage. He was there to carry out an important task.
Hello. We're at Troophead on a glorious afternoon, looking at a fantastic seabird city in front of us. I don't know, what is it, 200 foot of cliff, pretty well covered in seabirds. Most of what we're looking at are guillemots and razorbills, with quite a few kittiwakes in there as well. And right underneath our feet is the start of the gannet colony, which stretches from here all the way behind us, and there's thousands of pairs of gannets here as well.
With the type of forward planning, which is frankly rare for me, I took my monocular with me so I can actually see what's going on across there. And Ewan always describes the guillemots particularly as being like fleas in a rabbit's ear.
They do like each other's company.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't describe them as fleas in a rabbit's ear, but they certainly do like each other's company. Yes, they pack in very tight, and that's mainly a predator defence. So that if any predators, obviously avian predators in this case, if they come along, they can only pick off a few from the outside, and the ones right in the middle of the huddle are nice and safe.
What would be an avian predator around about here?
Herring gull, greater blackback gull, even peregrine will come and take, they won't take eggs off the cliff, but they'll come and take the adults flying around. They're particularly like kittiwakes as a light snack.
Yes, and it's interesting, they all face into the cliff. Is there a reason for that?
That's the way their toes work. So that it's literally that they're clinging on with their toes.
Okay.
So they've got webbed feet, but each toe is ended with a really quite a sharp claw.
Yeah.
And they just hook those on, and that's what they're using to stay on the cliff, quite literally, yeah. Hanging on by their toenails. And they don't make a nest of any shape or form at all. They just lay their egg onto bare rock. So quite a lot of them have got eggs underneath them at the moment, and they're busy incubating. The eggs are a really funny shape compared to what most people think of as an egg shape. They're much more of a pear.
Okay.
Much fatter at one end and down to quite a narrow point at the other end. And that is so that if the adult bird gets disturbed off the cliff, the egg doesn't roll. Mm. Or if it does roll, it rolls in a very tight circle rather than rolling off the edge of the cliff.
Mm.
So guillemots, particularly razorbills to a lesser extent, have these pear-shaped eggs rather than egg-shaped eggs.
I'm Kat, and I'm the Assistant Warden for the North East Scotland Reserve for the RSPB, and I am doing some seabird monitoring. I'm doing the standard annual stuff that we do every year, and I've just been mapping out breeding kittiwakes.
And are you counting actually individual birds within that photograph?
Yes. We have a few kittiwake plots on the site where we take a photo of them all, and I'm looking at each individual nest and I'm marking them down on this map here.
How much does this actually change year on year? I mean, the bottom of that photograph says 2009.
Yep, that's when the photo was originally taken, but quite a lot of the nests that I'm marking out here today are still on there. It's not the same for all the plots across the site.
Do you not get terribly distracted just by the wider picture?
Yes. Short answer that, yes, definitely. But I think it'd be strange if I didn't. When you're out here and you can see all these amazing birds and just the amazing surroundings, I think it'd be strange if I didn't get distracted.
What Kat's doing, though, she's doing something else with that photograph. Again, she's looking at a very specific area of kittiwakes, and she's mapping each nest within that area. And then we follow that nest through the season to see how productive they're being, how many chicks each pair gets, for example. And that gives us a very good idea of what the driving force for the population decline of some of these species are. I mean, kittiwakes, for example, they've gone down to 30% of what they used to be.
Yeah.
And a large part of that is that they're just not producing chicks anymore. That crash, it is kind of bottoming out. The rate of decline is slowing down. And we are seeing the actual productivity of the individual kittiwakes is getting slightly better. So we're hopeful we might have turn the bottom of that curve and hoping we might be going back up. Certainly, it was 4 years, I think, since we did a full colony count here, and the guillemots and the razorbills that have seen a similar decline, maybe not quite so extreme as the kittiwakes, but similar declines. That was our first indication that the numbers were going back up again, so we're hopeful. I mean, you think there's a lot of birds here now, and there are a staggering amount of birds here now, but if you'd been here 40 years ago, there would have been perhaps three times as many birds as there are here now.
And you know that for a fact?
Yes. Yeah, because, you know, as we're doing it now, our predecessors would have been sitting out here and counting as well.
I admire what Kat's doing. I mean, basically, there are three metal stakes driven into the cliff top, and she's wearing a climbing harness, and she's kind of sitting about 8-9 feet south of that. So she's safe enough. Just to be able to concentrate on this, because my eyes would be taken just by the movement all the time. I mean, it's just the sheer spectacle of this. You know, the blue skies, blue seas, green cliff tops, etc. Just the sheer amount of bird life packed into a really small space.
Oh, it's astonishing, isn't it? You know, I've been coming to seabird cities, as I call them, for 40 years now, and I never get fed up with it. I always, as you say, I have to stop and look and take in the spectacle before I stand a hope of trying to concentrate on the detail. It is absolutely astounding. Never get fed up with it. And, you know, the first, as you're coming along the path and the first bit, before you even see the birds, you get that great big whiff of guano. And I absolutely love that. I know
the aftershave for men.
I know a lot of people come along and they say, oh, what's that smell? But, oh, man, it's fantastic. I love it.
Richard Humpinch and his poncho for Eau de Gano.
I can actually smell that coming through the radio. I can just imagine exactly what that smells like.
That waft of fish as you look over the cliff.
Yeah, fantastic. But it's so astonishing. It's making me want to go to Fowles Heugh, which is the nearest set of cliffs to where I am. And I remember one time taking one of my children there for the first time, and they were just so astonished when you just walk along and suddenly see these thousands of birds there and the sound, and see, it's just such a wonderful wildlife spectacle.
But it's incredible, because it was up at Troophead recently, and there's nothing, and then in the last 3 feet suddenly you've got tens of thousands of birds there. And I think people underestimate it, because, you know, Fowles Heugh, Troophead, the Bass Rock, if you can get out to good and well, but that stuff's right on your doorstep. It's incredible.
Exactly, and it's of international importance as well. And also just observing how precarious the nests are and what these birds go through in order to raise their young.
I did that thing that Kat was doing, tied onto the posts when we were good, because Macduff Aquarium have a live feed from the cliffs into the aquarium, and we needed to change the camera out, so Landward thought that would be great. We'll just put Ewan on a harness and lower him over the cliff. And that is quite a sensation, but it's just a lovely sight.
I bet you love that. Oh, we've got some more correspondence here. Forrest in St Andrews said, it's a mystery bird guess, actually, hurrah, Charlotte. But you'll be pleased to know that it's wrong.
Name and shame.
Is the bird a female grouse? No. And saying here, my wife and I did the Ely Coastal Cliff chain walk and then hiked 8 miles to Pit and Weem yesterday. Weather has been perfect for getting out and enjoying the lands around us. Oh yes, that's good to hear. That's up and running. And Jane in Creef says she's about to go diving with her pals out of near Oban. Maybe we'll get to the Garvellach Islands and nip into the Puffer Bar for a wee treat. Yummy cakes. I've never heard of the Garvellach Islands.
Garvellachs? Yeah, but I didn't know there was a pub there.
Ah, well, you'll be stopping off there next time then.
We look at that. Anyway, the Highland Show takes place next week, albeit in a slightly different format. This year you can follow all the action online from Monday the 14th right through to Sunday the 20th of June.
And for so many people, including myself, the Highland Show is just such an important event in the year. I've been going there since I was...
Forever.
Yes, forever. So we've been remembering Highland shows of old and new. And a few years back, one of my favourite places to go is always the Rare Breeds tent, mainly because it's the only place in the showground where you can see pigs, which I just love. Because I remember when I first started going to the Highland Show when I was a child, they used to have pigs.
Yeah, and then they stopped.
Yes, I think something to do with disease. Straight to the pigs. And when I got there, a couple of white pigs were fast asleep in a deep bed of straw, idyllic. Ruth Dalton of the Rare Breed Survival Trust and Karen Kennedy Stewart of the British Pig Association explained what they were.
These are British lops.
Lops?
Lops, yeah. They're actually one of our most endangered species. They come from
Devon and Cornwall.
Devon and Cornwall, yes. They're a very good meat pig and they grow quite quickly as well.
I have to say I was slightly surprised because I'm used to the sort of saddlebacks, the blacks and Tamworth pigs, and that's what I was expecting to see. I wasn't expecting to see a pink pig, Ruth.
Well, therein lies the problem, because the only people keeping these traditional pig breeds now are, generally speaking, small-scale keepers. So there are a few larger herds, but mostly it's small-scale people. And just like you, they go, I want a pretty pig that has some colour to it and is ginger or spotty or stripy. And so the poor old white pigs, the original traditional breeds of white pigs, get left by the wayside. So if you look at our list of the most endangered breeds, on the pigs, it's all the white ones at the most critical, which is so ironic because they were the commercial pigs of the day. They were the most common pigs back in the 1950s, so it's come full circle, really.
And when you say endangered, then, how endangered are these British lops?
There's fewer than 200 breeding sows. Oh,
sell it to me. Why should people have a rare breed pig?
Because they taste so much better, and you cannot beat an outdoor reared rare breed pig. Even the level of fat, the quality of the fat, you need the fat to give the flavour to the muscle, to the meat, and it's just far superior in the outdoor rare breeds.
There must be an appeal to the animals themselves. I find them highly amusing and entertaining animals. Would you agree? Are they good animals to have around?
Oh, they're perfect animals for a small-scale keeper. They are. They're very biddable, but they're easy to work with. They're friendly. They're quite low maintenance as well, really.
We've come over to another corner of the tent here, and we've got some sheep that I think come from quite a way away, Ruth, am I right?
Yes, these sheep come from Orkney. They come from the most northern island of Orkney, which is North Ronaldsay. They are the seaweed-eating sheep. They're confined to the foreshore by a massive dike that keeps them off the centre of the island and the grassy areas, apart from at times like lambing. So they've adapted to eat seaweed.
I've actually been to North Ronaldsay a couple of times, and they are astonishing to see them in their own environment with that sea in the background.
Well, these must be culturally one of the most significant breeds that we look after as RBST. You know, they're so bound up with the history of the island. They're so well adapted to that very, very specific environment. You know, if they weren't kept on North Ronaldsay, they might start to lose those qualities. And obviously, many, many hundreds of them now are kept on the mainland. And that's excellent too, because spreading breeds around is great in terms of disease outbreak. But, you know, keeping them true to their roots as this hardy little sheep that lives literally on the rocks, isn't it? It's just, you know, the sea and rock and seaweed and all these little sheep running around. And they come in such a lovely variety of colours. They look so incredible against that backdrop, like you say.
I wonder how important that is with your whole mission with rare breeds, because so many of these animals are hefted to a particular region or area. How important is it to keep them to that area, but also then you want more people to be involved in keeping them beyond that particular environment as well?
It's a constant debate in loads of breeds. You know, the equines, there's hill ponies that people argue they're being taken off the hill and they're losing their qualities. And I would say that, you know, there's room for all of it. It's really important to showcase the wide variety of attributes these breeds have. And a fell pony, where I come from in Cumbria, a fell pony on the fell is a wonderful thing, living in its free living environment, coping with that weather. But then a pony from one of those herds can go down and win its class at Olympia, and I think that just shows what incredible versatility our native breeds have. And if we did suffer some catastrophic loss of native breed livestock, the agricultural world generally, the commercial agricultural world, would be much the poorer for it.
I've popped over to the other end of the tent now, where there's a cow and calf, a beautiful sort of dark chestnut, gingery cow. What's this?
This is a red poll. And the red poll's quite an exciting breed for us because it's not actually rare. And that sounds a bit weird, but one of the things I get quite a lot is, oh, they're rare for a reason. And this is one of the examples I can say to people, well, this was rare and it's not now. So things are not rare for a reason. They're generally rare because they're not promoted enough or in the right place. And the Red Poll Society very cleverly realised here was a dual-purpose animal, one that was bred to produce beef and milk. And therefore, in today's environment, when very few people would milk a red poll commercially, here was a beef animal that had lots of milk. So this is of huge interest to commercial farmers who might have a continental breed that doesn't give a lot of milk, but cross it with a red poll. Not only is there a natural polling, which means they have no horns naturally, so it takes the horns off the calf, but also that offspring, if it's a female, has loads of milk for its calf, but all the commercial attributes of the continental breed. So they're a really great crossing breed.
She looks gentle. She's just licking away at her calf there. Quite small.
Yes, they are not a big breed, and you're right, they're very maternal, and she's there giving a good face wash to her rather long-suffering calf. So, you know, that's another quality that gets lost when you breed breeds purely for meat. They lose those maternal qualities, they lose the easy calving qualities. So that's what our native breeds have in spades. They evolved at a time when you couldn't just call the vet out. You didn't have lots of medication at your disposal. So
hardy.
Hardy and low maintenance and maternal. And across all the species, that's what they've got in spades, really.
Ruth Dalton and Karen Kennedy-Stewart at the 2018 Royal Highland Show. And if you'd like details about how to access that online experience, go to our website for details. But also Fiona Clark from Landward, previously of Out of Doors, is going to go and get some recordings for us as well to experience a very different Royal Highland Show.
It will be different without the crowds, but I think the thing that's always one of the many highlights for me is seeing livestock at their best. The fact that people have spent so much time and energy and dedication into making the cattle and the horses and the sheep look just fabulous.
Yeah, one of the folk, I've been seeing a few folk about it and just saying, questioning, was it worth putting all that effort in if there weren't going to be the crowds to see it?
Is it not a personal pride thing, though, showing off your livestock?
It's not just pride, it's money as well.
Yeah, but there'll still be people who are within the industry, because, of course, it is a big industry event, who'll be looking at these cattle and so on, thinking that's a good breeding line or whatever. You know, there's still value in it, I'm sure.
Yeah, and for a lot of farmers, that is their annual holiday.
Yes.
They get in the caravan, they put the beasts in the back of a truck, and they go down for a week, and that is, hard to believe if you're outside farming, that is the holiday.
Yeah, indeed. So now it is time for another snippet of this week's Mystery Bird. Some people already on the go with their answers, but plenty of time to join in. Here it is. Do you know what bird makes that sound? You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, standard network message rate applies, and you can call as well. Finlay's there, he's on 08 085 92 95 00. We've had some answers. No correct
answers.
Yeah, no,
we're doing well so far.
Feeling pretty pleased about that.
John and Lewis and Rothy Norman said, good morning, Helen and Ewan. It's a wild guess, but is the mystery bird this morning a demented coot? No, it isn't, but hang on in there. Thank you for your interesting programme. Looking forward to the dowsing. We've dabbled a bit and very good at not finding blocked field drains. She blames the bent wire wrong gauge. Well, I've got my big super duper dowsing runs with me, so we'll try that live.
Yeah. Gary and Pennycook also says, is it a coot? Another one saying coot here. Andrew Barry from Broxburn Mystery Bird, is it a coot? Katie in Perth says, sounds like a cock pheasant. And Alice in Aberdeenshire says, mystery bird woodcock, I am going with my gut today. Last week I doubted myself, thinking it could not be a corncrake and got it wrong. So here goes. And I went on boat trips on the Waverley from Ilfracombe on holidays in Devon.
Fantastic. Because talking the Waverley smacks of production here. The Waverley has not had its troubles to seek in recent years, but I'm pleased to say the trips down the water could be back on soon. Paul Semple, who's director of the Waverley Steam Navigation Company, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello there.
Paul, I'm sure everybody wants to know, when is the Waverley likely to set sail again?
Well, today on testing and trials, but we're hoping to release the timetable beginning of next week and start operating Waverley in 2 weeks' time to passengers again.
So just give us an idea, Paul, of what you've come through to reach this point, because you've had your woes, haven't you?
Yes, a ship of Waverley's age has certainly got character through the years, but yes, in recent times, our more recent kind of crisis with the ship was in 2019 when she was withdrawn from service, pending new boilers. We then had the $2.3 million appeal, and we managed to raise those funds in just 6 months and reboiler Waverley. Wow. But like everything else last year, COVID hit us hard. And then there was an incident with Brodick Pier last year. But we're back on the water. The ship has been out on trials this week. So we're looking forward to welcoming passengers again.
And the way you talk about her is so fondly, actually. She seems to be a character. So many people hold the Waverley in fond regard. I know somebody who actually goes on practically every trip because she's so enthusiastic about the Waverley. What do you think the appeal is for people?
I think, unlike any other vessel, a paddle steamer seems like she's alive. You know, the paddle steamer, when she arrives at a pier, it's very visual. You see the sort of paddle boxes foam as the paddles go astern. The sound of her, even in the distance, you can hear the paddle beat for miles away in a flat, calm sea. You know, so unlike any other ship, she really does have this character that comes alive. It's as if the ship has the personality.
But it seems such a... This is a double-edged sword here. It seems out of place in many of the islands in the west coast of Scotland. And then you see it coming round the corner, and it's just so magical. It puts a smile on your face. I've seen it many times. You know, I've been out in the boat, and suddenly the Waverley's coming past, and the world stops till you've gone past.
Yes, and I think, you know, she adds colour to the Clyde. You know, those funnels, when you see them coming, there's something that attracts, that draws all ages. It's the atmosphere of the ship that, you know, like the Clyde steamers would have been of the past when they arrived at piers, particularly around the Clyde coast, you know, these small village piers, the steamer would have arrived, it's been hustle and bustle of the steamer, and then off it went and things were quiet again.
And the Waverley is celebrating 75 years, the 75th anniversary this year. Well, just give us a little rundown of the history.
Yes, so she was built in 1946 and launched in October 46, so it'll be her 75th year since launch. And Waverley was built after the war to replace a ship of similar name that had been lost through the war. And for the first sort of 20 years of Waverley's career, she was almost like the sort of afterthought steamer. But by the early 70s, she was the last Clyde steamer. And from 1972, she's held the title of the last seagoing paddle steamer in the world. And it's very well known that Waverley was sold for £1, but in really sense she was gifted because the pound was a donation that purchased her from Caledonian Mount Brain. And then she entered her preservation career, which is now over 45 years of been operating in preservation.
So how many times have you been in danger of losing the Waverley? Especially, boilers was a big worry.
Yeah, and in one sense, Waverley's always fighting for survival. You know, she's not economically viable, and we really do rely on support from people donating and from companies giving things at cost. So she's always fighting for survival, and everyone that sails in Waverley helps to keep her sailing. And, you know, as Waverley is obviously an old ship now, but in finding parts for her, for example, it's not as if you can just go up to B&Q and get a spare part for a paddle steamer. So therefore, ordering parts, and this winter we've carried out a lot of work on the main engine, and some of those parts took 5 months to source and manufacture.
And what about the C word, the COVID word then? How does that impact on the experience of being on the ship?
What it does do to us, obviously, is reduce capacity. We're looking at operating just about a third of our normal capacity. So in that sense, the ship will be quieter, giving passengers more space. And I know from last year when we sailed, people were commenting the fact that they did have an awful lot more space. But in order to operate wave like that, we'd have to do almost double the fares. So we'll be operating similar procedures to last year, which worked very well, slightly adapted them, you know, with experience. But I still think the Waverley experience will be worthwhile, particularly this year of coasts and waters. You know, there's no other vessel can give you the Clyde coast like Waverley can.
Well, what are you going to be doing for it?
So what we've done is we've got quite an extensive timetable planned so that Waverley will get to almost every part of the Clyde coast. And we've got some popular cruises, for example, through the Kyles of Bute, round buttes, but we've also got the odd cruise like round Isles of Craig, which is a real seagoing trip all the way down to Isles of Craig.
So is there a lot of demand?
Yes, what we are expecting is when we release the timetable and open bookings, there will be demand. Because of reduced capacity, we really need to try and sell at that capacity in order just to cover our daily running costs. Waverley really needs to earn about £12,000 a day just for basic costs.
Well, good luck with it, and thanks for joining us this morning. And to anybody who's not done it, it really is a magical trip, especially round the Kyles of Bute. There is something absolutely magical about the Waverley. So we wish you well with it. Thanks, Paul.
Right, thank you very much.
So have you been on the Waverley?
No, I have never been on the
Waverley. It's on the tick list.
On the Waverley, I would absolutely love to do it. I just love ships. And I guess it's got its own sounds as well, its own feel, its own smell. I would just absolutely love to
and
go on it.
And it ties up outside the BBC at Pacific Quay.
Which yeah, we could just jump on.
The ideal way to go. Anyway, thanks very much for staying with us so far. We've got loads coming up. We've got the Stone Circle, which provides inspiration for a composer. And we're going fishing. And hopefully we're going to try some live dowsing here in the car park at BBC Aberdeen.
But first, here's another blast of this week's mystery bird. See if you can guess what it is.
It's not easy. Keep on thinking it's going to slip into being a capercaillie, but it's not.
No, it's not. Get in touch if you think you know what it is. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, and you can call Finlay on 0808 592 9500. And quite a few people have been getting in touch, actually. I think we have three correct answers
so far.
Well,
first of all, Martin Farfer's got it wrong. He said it's a woodcock. No, it's not.
Fred Godden in West Lothian says, is the mystery bird a water rail? Nope. Jane Stokes near Bewley says, the bird is a curlew. She's convinced. But I'm sorry, Jane, that's not the right answer. And Susan and Jeff Dunn from Eaglesham say, morning, Ewan and Helen, we'll go for a turkey being strangled.
Yeah, now you're getting close. I'm loving these creative wrong answers.
Yes, this is becoming a bit of a thing, isn't it? Pam from Lossie says, is the bird a pheasant? And she says, ta for another interesting programme. I had planned to visit Troophead very soon. Now all your audience know what a special place it is. There'll be as many folk as seabirds. Ah! Well,
yeah, but it's a big place.
Enough space for everyone.
It's stretched out and, yeah, it's really well. Now's the time to go.
Derek in Dalmahoy says, is today's mystery bird a red-legged partridge?
No.
Martin in Forfar says, a capercaillie. I'm up at 6 every day. I think that means week to catch the show, and it always makes my week. Thank you very much. Oh, here we go. Ian in Troon says, is it a Geiger counter?
Fantastic.
Karen in Shetland says, is it a grated spotted windscreen chamois polisher? And David Long at Spottiswood says, is it a close relative of last week's Is It the Water Rail? No, it isn't. But are you going to give a little clue at this point?
Folk are getting in the right, the water rail, wrong bird.
Right environment?
Right kind of environment, but I'm loving these wrong answers. You could see the Geiger counter a bit.
Yeah, yeah. And an email here from Alan Henley, who says, well into our 20th plus year of rising at 6:30 every Saturday to be entertained and informed. Brilliant reporting. Al and Linny camping at South Whitley Burn Farm near Largs. A wee call out to Katie, whose site this is. Wonderful host. And our pals Gemma Scott and young Molly camping as a family for the first time. Keep up the excellent work. Oh, that's always exciting going for a camping trip, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, it took me literally decades to see an otter. Everybody would say, oh, there's hundreds of them playing on the beach. But I finally saw one in Arran after many, many years, and then saw more in Jura just a couple of years ago. And sometimes they are the most elusive of animals, which means if you're trying to capture them with film, it can be hard. But if you go online this week, Hugh Harrop in Shetland's got some amazing footage of an orca trying to catch an otter. Otter versus killer whale, that's entertainment.
Wow. Well, Andy Harrod is a wildlife photographer who's been following otters for the past 8 years. Recently, Mark and I went to meet him at North Keswick on the Bewley Firth to hear all about them and hopefully spot one.
Nothing surprises me with otters. And I've heard people talk about otters bumping into them, at 2,500 feet up on mountains. So they travel great distances. They quite often pop up in the middle of Inverness.
The sun's actually come out. When we came out of the car, it was sort of sleety rain, but it's a nice afternoon now. Shall we go further along, see if we can find somewhere just to sort of sit quietly and see if we can spot one?
Yeah.
See, you're spotting something already, aren't you?
There's an osprey with a fish. And the gulls are trying
to... The gulls are mobbing it.
And it's coming right over our head.
Oh, that's fabulous.
There you go. Happy days. That looks like a mullet-type fish. It's a decent-sized fish.
Yeah.
Maybe two and a half pounds, something like that.
Yeah. I like the way it kind of turns it to line up
yeah.
the direction its body's going, so it's kind of streamlining the load.
Aerodynamic, yeah. Well, there you go. I thought we might see ospreys here. Yeah. There are actually quite a few in this area. Again, another species that are doing really well, yeah. another fish-eating species.
You said that otters are doing well. Why do you think that is?
Because they've now got legal protection, that was very important they got that. But mainly they're recovering now from the huge problem they had with DDT in the ecosystem. Them being top of the food chain, they got this concentration of these chemicals that don't degrade at all. And it was making them infertile in the sort of late 50s and then 60s, 70s. You know, all these chemical build-up caused them huge problems. And did wipe them out in certain areas, which is why I mentioned the fact that they're in every county in the UK now, because that's a huge milestone for that to occur. It's probably worth having a look in these rocks, because there might be some spraint on these rocks. Yeah. So normally what I do is, if I was looking in an area that I haven't found signs of otters being here before, if there's any sort of big flat areas of grass, I would check for the indentation where an otter's been rolling, because they will roll in the same spots on a regular basis.
Why do they roll?
Yeah.
It's basically to get the salt out the fur and the pelage. When they're drying off, they get sort of sticky with the salt. So it's really just to clean it off. Interestingly, in Shetland, nearly all the otters that I photograph up there roll on grass, whereas in the Hebrides, most of the otters that I photograph there roll in seaweed. Even though there is grass, and it's obviously just behavioural patterns that have been passed from generation to generation of otters.
What they've been taught to do in that area.
Exactly, because mum has a lot to teach an otter in you know, the year to 18 months that the cubs are with her. Where to go and drink, where to fish, where to go and look for frogs in the spring, for example, different seasonal food items. But the thing that amazes me with otters is the amount of food they can pack away into what is quite a compact animal. They must have incredibly strong stomach muscles to be able to compress the amount of food that they have. I witnessed an otter catching about a 2-3 pound lump sucker fish up in Shetland. And she ate virtually everything apart from maybe just a tiny scrap of skin. Because when she went back out fishing again, I went and checked and see what she'd left. And she caught immediately another lump sucker fish, but bigger this time. Came in, ate half of that, and then went and curled up for about 4 hours under a rock. The reason I know it was 4 hours is because I sat for 4 and a quarter hours watching her sleeping under this rock. How on earth could she fit that amount of fish into her stomach? So the stomach muscles must be really strong. I've seen them taking lobsters as well, and they'll eat the whole of a lobster apart from the claws. They haven't quite got the strength in the jaws to crush the claws of a lobster.
You mentioned earlier that you spent 4 hours watching an otter sleep. What are you doing at that point? Are you just taking photographs?
Yeah, I'll be photographing it, I'll be filming it. If I've got 4G, I'll be on social media doing live tweets. Quite often do that, which people love, you know, if they're sitting in an office in London and they follow me on Twitter or Instagram, mainly Twitter, you know, they quite often comment back, and here's me stuck at a computer desk doing spreadsheets and
you're photographing. Swine,
yeah, yeah, words to that effect, yes. Yeah, it's quite a nice office to have. When you're with something as special as an otter, time becomes absolutely irrelevant, and you basically look at the sun and it's in a position in the sky, and then you suddenly realize it's right over the back of your shoulder and it's almost beyond the horizon and it's going to get dark soon. So time as a concept that we live on a day-to-day life of you know, getting up at 7 o'clock and, you know, having breakfast at 8, walking the dog, whatever, and then going to work, that doesn't exist in my life when I'm out with otters. It's we are on otter time. When you spend a lot of time with one particular animal, they do become aware of you being around. But because nothing bad's happening and you're not moving about too noisily and you're not causing them distress, they will accept you as part of their habitat. Mm. And when I'm photographing an otter that's maybe coming with a big fish, for example, and if I'm a little bit closer than I would be happy with, I'll take one photograph and my camera will make obviously a clicking noise. And if that otter reacts and it looks at me, I'll leave it for another 2 minutes before I take another picture. And then the reaction from that otter quite often will be a lot less than it was the first time, because nothing bad happened on the back of that noise of the camera. And over a period of time, especially if it's an otter with a big fish, like a conger eel, for example, where it might be eating it for 45 minutes to an hour, by half an hour into a photography session, I'll be rattling off 5 frames a second and that otter won't even be blinking. They do get used to a sound or a presence being there, but as long as nothing bad happens, they'll accept it and relax.
Andy Howard, Andy's book is incredible. The Secret Life of Otters is out now, and I got a copy from Andy a wee while back, and it's just incredible images.
Yeah, amazing. If you have a listen to the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast on BBC Sounds, and you can find out whether we actually saw an otter or not on the Bewley Firth. Something very interesting that Andy said in that is that he has spent a lot of time in the past year during the lockdown just walking miles and miles and miles. And he said he walked all the way around the Black Isle. He says he's found otters on every mile.
They are making a huge comeback.
Yeah.
Even around me, I've seen otters. Oh, sorry, I'm going to be honest here. Some of my neighbours have seen otters.
Right,
okay. I haven't actually seen them yet. But some of the images, as I said in the book, these fish are massive.
Yeah.
Otter against a conger eel.
Yes, exactly. Astonishing. The other thing that I enjoyed about that was him talking about otter time, the concept of otter time. And this is something we were exploring yesterday, actually, or for an interview that we were doing for another podcast, about this whole thing about just actually stopping and spending time and waiting for nature and for the birds just to come to you.
But you do wonder, Andy's wife's a wildlife photographer as well, when they ever see each other.
Yeah. Well, he's going out at all sorts of strange times of the day and night.
But he's going up, I mean, you've probably got that. I went up with Andy, we were looking for mountain hares. And just that extra layer of information and that knowledge of the natural history, because you can't just be a wildlife photographer. You've got to be a biologist, a zoologist, an ecologist as well.
Well, I think it's the close observation, isn't it? Because you spend so much time, you're spending 4 hours watching an otter sleep, you spend so much time observing these animals that you know them intimately. You have to know them intimately, otherwise you can't find them to take the good photographs.
Yeah, not only that, he also takes, he's taking folk out as groups to learn about photography, and that pressure, if you're taking a group out to spot the wild mountain hare or spot the otter, must be quite intense. So, yeah, you're going to get good at it.
Yep, exactly.
Now, stone circles. Here's a really sweeping, obvious statement. Special places, but a more difficult question is we're not sure why.
Fiddler and composer Paul Anderson regularly feels drawn to his local stone circle near Tarland in Aberdeenshire, and he goes there to seek inspiration for tunes.
And one day he took some dowsing rods there with some interesting results.
We're in the middle of the Howe of Cromar, which Tarland would be the biggest settlement in the area, and we're walking up the path to Tamnaviri Stone Circle.
You can see it from your house, mm-hmm. And it's a place that you come to quite regularly.
I do. I mean, I just like coming up. That's the only reason, but I've quite often composed music up here. From my own point of view, it's just a nice, quiet spot in the middle of the Howe. I just find I can get my head into the subject, but I find for me, if I'm writing music, it's somewhere I can go that usually once I get my head cleared, mm-hmm. Something will come along the lines of what I'm hoping to create.
Thank you. you're somebody that does spend quite a lot of time in your local area composing and playing music, you like to be out and about and outside and taking inspiration from particular places.
I mean, I'm fae here. I mean, my family have come from this part of the world. Oh, I'll go way, way back. So I feel very rooted to this area. I suppose, like a lot of composers, I find inspiration in lots of different places. In my home area, which I think there's an element of attachment, but love for a place, is always a good inspiration. Even from the time I was quite young, I used to like just sitting in an evening and listen to the curlews and the lapwings, the peasies, things like that. So there's no shortage of inspiration here.
Here we are at the Stone Circle just now, and you described when you used the dowsing rods, and what did they do when you got here?
Well, I suppose dowsing's a controversial thing. Some folk would say it's a lot of nonsense. My own great-uncle, Jimmy Anderson, used to be hired in very dry summers. I mean, I suppose folk would think about 1976, if they're old enough. It was a particularly dry summer, and a lot of water supplies dried up, and you found landowners and farmers needed water for livestock. So he was hired numerous times to find water through dowsing, and he could tell you exactly how deep it was. So to me, it's just, I think your body, although you didn't notice it, it's picking stuff like that up all the time. So quite by accident, we were looking for Bonnie Prince Charlie's cave at Arisaig. My mate Ian says, well, you could try the dowsing, because if you're looking for anything, they supposedly help. Sounds ridiculous, but we found it through that. Now, Ian got some high-tension wire he found lying about and made a couple of rods, and we could roughly get it for it was. Now, you have to mind, he'd been there before, but he couldn't find it. So we got in, and I thought, I'm going to try this. Can I have a shot? And it seemed to work. So if I go back home to the Mains of Kincraigie here, I kent there further was a water line, roughly. And so I tried it. And sure enough, it seemed to work. And it wasn't me deliberately doing it, because I couldn't tell you the exact point, but I found it. And so
what,
I thought,
what does it feel like then?
For me, nothing, really.
I mean, do they just start moving?
Some folk use like a little cups, mm-hmm. copper cups, and the rods will move themselves. So there's really no sense that you are physically trying to get them to move. And coming up here, I thought, let's just see what happens. I mean, I'd heard that stone circles are often for ley lines cross. Now, where we are just now, this farm here is called White Ley. Uh-huh. Just over there is the farm The Lies. Traditionally, there's an understanding of something going on. I reckon why I did it, I just thought, I'm going to start walking to the bottom of the path. In fact, I found as I came up, they started reacting at certain points, and they would cross, and as you left that point, they would uncross. And then I would get to certain bits, you'd find it was almost, they were going in reverse. And I'm looking at that thinking, well, maybe that's like positive and negative charges. So that's kind of how I interpreted it. But when I got to the top, there was a very strong reaction. And I had my elbows bent, and so the rods basically come round and were being stopped by my own arms. And so what I did was I extended my arms out, and the rods, they began to slowly spin, kind of independently. They weren't going together, synchronised. One would spin and the other would slowly go, and this would repeat itself. And it, to me, that kind of confirmed there was definitely something about the place. It's more than just, I think they were plotting the heavens. Possibly that's part of it, but I think there's more going on and folk have just forgotten what it is. But that's not why I come here, although maybe that's why, partly
you might be drawn here, but you don't realise there's some sort of energy that draws you here.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can see where we are. I mean, it's a splendid spot. Uh-huh. I mean, you've got a great outlook. But I just find it's just an inspiring place just to be. You've got this, what's probably the oldest site in the Hale Howe, with the recumbent Steen Circle. I can see Loch na Garr, Mount Keane, Morven, Clach na Benz over there. And surrounded by farmland that my ancestors have been farming since, I think the furthest we managed to look back without really delving in is back to kind of late 1600s, certainly the 1700s. I find that whole thing quite inspiring, personally. That's basically what an Aeolian harp does. You can, the wind goes across the strings and makes them sing. So if you're in the wind at the right angle, they'll do this, which can be a nicely eerie experience.
The sound of the wind catching the strings on Paul Anderson's fiddle at the Tom Laviri Stone Circle near Tarnant.
It was a very special experience. It just happened, actually, that thing with the strings. It was lovely.
Yeah, that takes it to a whole new level. We're very curious here on Out of Doors to find out more about dowsing. Joining us now, we've got Graham Gardner, former president of the British Society of Dowsers, and now a vocational geomancer. Graham, welcome to the programme. Obvious question. What is a geomancer?
Geomancer, the easiest way to explain it is to think of it like Western feng shui.
That's short and sweet.
Yeah, I can give you the long explanation, but people start to glaze over.
Oh, just go on then.
Oh, no, you're, Graham, you're in the right place. There'll be no glazing here.
geomancy is the act of placing structures on the earth so that they are in harmony with the earth energies and beneficial to human life.
Wow.
So how does dowsing work then, and why is it so effective?
Well, how does it work? There are many theories on that, but in the case of like water dowsing, we think that the body has a lot of subconscious stuff that we're not really consciously aware of, but the body is picking up all these impulses. And it seems in water dowsing there is a disturbance in the geomagnetic field above a water line that the body can pick up on, and the dowsing rods just let us access those subconscious impulses. So there are these little muscle twitches that the rods just amplify.
Can it be divisive, though? Some people think it's an absolute load of nonsense. Not me, I'm a total convert. I mean, I believe it.
Yeah, it is still very divisive. I mean, there is no sort of scientific basis for this. Anytime any sort of laboratory-type testing is done, it seems to fail. But, you know, artificial testing produces artificial results. There are many water dowsers with very long track records of successful well drilling. You know, George Applegate, who was one of the BSD's best water dowsers, had a record of better than 4,000 wells with like over a 90% success rate.
Well, Graham, we're going to try it right now.
Well, I've just got a couple of questions, okay. Yeah, about this, first of all, because Paul Anderson said that farmers were actually using it in the dry summer of 1976 to find water because they needed to. It was desperate. What kind of modern day or contemporary application does it have? Are people using this for practical reasons right now?
Yeah, we still find farmers who are trying to find boreholes on the land for water supplies, you know, particularly like dairy farms have quite a large demand for water.
So can anybody take it up? Or do you need
anybody
that?
Can do it.
Do you need that special touch? Because we're going to put it to the test, Graham, because I've got my brass rods that I've used, I think, with some success. And I've got a mug of water and an empty cup, both with bowls over the top. So Helen's going to take the rods.
So, Graham, can you give me any advice? Because I've never done this before, so I'm just picking up these rods.
Right, these sort of tests don't tend to work terribly well. If you're in the car park, I know there is a water vein running underneath the car park.
Well, we'll just give this a go, because I tried it earlier on and it worked six times for me.
So you have to hold the rods just so your arms relaxed, and the rods should be shoulder width apart. And the closer you have to the horizontal, the more sensitive they will be. So you want to tilt them up, almost like you're holding a six gun.
Okay.
Yep. And just below the horizontal, so they're not flapping about wildly.
Yep.
And then you just concentrate on water. You just have to have this mental focus that you're looking for water and try and walk forward and see if they cross over the one cup or the other.
Oh, they're crossing. Oh, my goodness.
Well, keep going. They've crossed.
They've crossed over this upturned bowl.
If you keep going, with any luck, they should uncross.
And then as I walked away, they uncrossed.
Yeah.
Now, okay, go and try it with the other one.
Gosh, that is a really remarkable experience.
Right,
wow.
So
well,
they've crossed over.
Right, though.
Crossed over one, Graham. So.
Okay, I'm going to do exactly the same and approach the next upturned bowl and see what happens. No, they're not crossing.
Okay, big reveal time. Take them off.
I'm just going to... Yep, it was right. It worked.
There you go.
Wow, that was an experience. Gosh, and it just felt like they were totally doing their own thing there.
It's bizarre, because I knew which one the waters were in the grain when I was trying it, so there's always a potential for subconscious tweaking of the rods, but that was completely unrehearsed. That's quite a result.
Well, there you go. Anybody can do it.
Yep. And what about you? Is it something that you do regularly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a sort of professional geomancer, so I do go out and do it quite a lot, yeah.
I'm intrigued about the geomancy as well, so it's not just water, but is it the placing of objects, you said?
Yeah, well, most of my day-to-day work is in house healing work. We find there are things, if houses have particular configurations of earth energies, they're maybe not that healthy for the humans. So we can go and we try and either move them or amend them so that they're beneficial. Because so it kind of gets into the realm of shamanism.
It's fascinating. I have a friend who was having relationship issues. This is 2-3 years ago. And he got somebody in to do exactly that with a degree of success. I was pretty sceptical, but is it applicable in that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. It depends on the cause of the relationship issues, of course, but that is the sort of thing that we do get called in for, yeah.
And what kind of thing do you actually do to adapt the environment or change the flow?
Again, depends on what the exact thing is. You use your dowsing as the means of going through a lot of questions to find out what the cause is. In the case of water lines that are carrying what we call geopathic stress, we can do things like earth acupuncture, which is we put in a metal rod into the centre of the stream, which kind of disrupts the magnetic field and stops it flowing through the building.
Did you feeling something? Just taking back to dowsing, are you aware of something happening independent of you?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, yeah.
And just a final question for me about that. Paul Anderson was talking about his experience taking the rods up to the Tom Naviri Stone Circle and the different reactions. Can you explain that at all? Do you know what's going on
yes.
there?
Well, actually, Tom Naviri, I have a very close connection with that. In fact, I do sort of like to claim some responsibility for reactivating it. Because this is way back in 20 years ago, at the start of my geomancy training, we were doing a group meditation and we found, the idea was to find a spot that needed some energy, like a stone, a sacred site that was lacking in energy. And one of the group came up with this stone circle in Aberdeenshire, which at the time we had no idea was being restored by the archaeologists. So about 18 months went by and eventually a group of us went up there. They were just myself and two others. And we spent a week working with the circle and just bringing it back to life. Wow. And when we first arrived there, I couldn't douse anything in the circle apart from a lot of little spirals. It was like a sort of bubbling soup pot. But over the course of the week, we hummed, we sang to the stones, we played didgeridoo, we did lots of dowsing. Things started to come back to life, and by the end of the week, all the lays were back in place.
That's amazing. And now you hear about Paul's experience of the rods really picking up on something there.
Yeah, and a couple of years after we did that, I met up with a Celtic shaman, Geo Trevathan, and told her this story, and she said Tom Naviri was the first stone circle she'd actually walked into and felt she didn't have to do any preparatory work.
Well, Graham, kind of speechless, but absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much, and I'm so delighted that our dowsing worked. So thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you.
You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland with me, Ewan McElraith, and Helen Needham. If you miss any of this, there's a few ways to catch up.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking at the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. And we do like hearing from where you listen. Email us your stories out of doors, which is what Alex McDonald did. And he said, I was first introduced to Out of Doors in the spring of 2019 when my girlfriend and my partner used it as motivation to get up for early shifts at Glasgow Royal Infirmary. Now, over 3 years later, I use it as my soundtrack to heading out on morning drives to the hills, both Munros and lesser known peaks.
During this time, however, I was coming to the end of a near decade-long aim of qualifying as an architect. I successfully completed this aim in early March this year. Having your dulcet tones as company throughout the many months of the first lockdown and the difficult months leading up to and around my exams has definitely benefited my mental health. And to be honest, I'm not sure I would have come this far without them. Best regards, Alec Mack. Time to put in your final offerings for this week's mystery bird. Do you know what this is? Do get in touch if you think you know. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can text 80295, standard network message rate applies. And you can call as well. Finley's there, 08 085 92 95 00. I think we've got a handful of right answers.
Yeah, there's quite a few, yeah. Now, as Bing Crosby crooned, you don't read that very often in Out of Doors. I'll tell you why I can't find you. Every time I go to your place, you go on fishing. So what's the appeal of sitting on a riverbank whiling away the hours? Well, Mark asked Bob Lawton of the Findhorn, Nain and Lossie Fisheries Trust exactly why on the banks of the Findhorn.
It's a number of things, really. If you, once it's actually been in a nice part of the countryside, being beside flowing waters, always quite soothing and comforting. And there's always that little bit of basic hunter instinct as well that makes you want to try and catch something for your dinner, in effect. Although these days we release all the fish back to the river. I recall doing a bit of research many years ago looking at performance of anglers, myself included to some extent. 25% anglers caught over 75% of the fish in this particular area we were looking at. Why do the other 75 keep coming back? They get one maybe once every 10, 15 years or something? Or, you know, because salmon fishing's, you know, quite a difficult skill, but there's something that keeps them coming back, so it must be some of these extra things, as well as just trying to catch the fish.
Yeah. Mm. And there's just, again, where we're sitting at the moment, the Findhorn's quite low, but the sun's shining in the water. You know, you've got shadows of the trees across there. You can hear all the birds, you know, the chaffinches and the chiff-chaffs and everything else. It just kind of empty your brain.
Yeah, and it's a lovely place to work too, but don't take it lightly. We're looking at it today in a nice, benign fashion, I suppose, if you wanted to use a word. It's lovely, it's low flow, it's lovely and sunny, but this can be a dangerous river like all rivers and can change in its complexion and be much faster after several days of rain, etc. And some can be quite damaging as well. And that in itself leads to some issues with managing the river and protecting the fish within it, but also the land around it as well.
Do you ever... I mean, I find this with the sea sometimes. Sometimes I want to know what's going on underneath the surface of the sea. Yeah, because where we're sitting at the moment, yeah, you can see partially through the river, but, you know, when I was a kid, I used to get a dive mask and just basically hang onto a rock and watch the fish in the river. It's fascinating.
Yes, it is, and we use that occasionally as a survey technique these days, but I quite enjoy doing that myself, and not so much these days, but certainly when I was younger. Because you can understand a little bit of the fish, it tells you where they maybe hide, for instance, a little bit, what they use, how they use the flow, that sort of thing. But equally, I always sort of think that you know, people look at rivers and say there's nothing in there. Well, actually, you go and stick a mask on or get a glass bucket or whatever, you'll see a lot more in there than what you believe.
We're talking about, megafauna is the wrong word, but I mean, we're talking about relatively big animals in the water, the fish themselves. But there's an awful lot of smaller stuff. I mean, just in terms of biomass, a massive amount of smaller stuff in there.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole system depends on those invertebrates, smaller insects, which, you know, live and breed in the water, and that provides food for the fish, both salmon, sea trout and other fish species, such as eels and other things that we find in our rivers. So highly important as well. There is work to suggest that the invertebrate populations are beginning to decline as well. The surveys we've done here seems to indicate the Findhorn's holding up pretty well. We're still finding the key species. But again, it needs careful thought, careful management and protection in many instances. An area we're particularly keen to drive towards is also looking at the riparian structure, riparian banks and tree cover. We're seeing much warmer springs. We're sitting out here today with no jackets on. Maybe we should have a jacket on. It should be colder. The river today's up nearly 9 degrees. It'll probably be 10 degrees by the end of the day. And that's in April. It should probably be a few degrees lower. So we're beginning to see possibly that climate change is affecting the temperature, and that may be affecting the survival of smolts and other fish as well. So we're looking at projects, for instance, to create shading along riverbanks in the future, which might help us at least to keep temperature down a little bit, but also retain water and soften off the effects of big spates, that type of thing.
Do you use, I'm trying to think of a way of phrasing this without it being offensive, I used to use the fishing rod as an excuse for escaping from the office. I'm going to do some research, goodbye, and I'd be gone for the day. I wonder how many people actually, they take all the gear, they take all the, you know, the fly box and everything else with them.
Yeah.
Just because it would seem a bit odd if they just sat by a riverbank doing nothing for 5 hours.
Yeah, I guess guilty as charged. And certainly my mum was quite happy to see us heading off with fishing rods as a youth. Maybe less so as I've gotten older. My success rate as an angler is pretty, pretty poor compared to many others. Again, referring to a little bit of work I did many, many years ago, we looked at that. Actually, you know, why are you going fishing? Because, again, we're interested to see why... 75% of people still turn up, basically. And that did come up as an excuse. It was just to get away from it and get away from nearest and dearest and relax a little bit and so on. So it is a reasonable reason for going, for sure.
Well, Lawton of the Findhorn Nairn and Lossie Fisheries Trust, never really got fishing.
I'm quite happy just to sit on a riverbank without a fishing rod.
Yeah, I mean, we could always take a camera and just wait for otters.
Yeah, you could do. We've got some comments here. Craig and Lindsay from Devon saying, morning from just outside Exeter. This weekend, we're packing for our trip to hike the Speyside Way. Brilliant. Wow. From Wednesday next week, 100k over 10 days through lovely Scottish forests and trails. Can't wait. Well, I've done the Speyside Way and I'd highly recommend. But I have to say, it was a little disappointing at the end when it got to Bucky.
I did the river in a rubber raft with a band called the...
Oh, yes, the Speyside River Band. Yeah, yeah, they're great.
And
yeah.
Basically, they were all on rafts and they stopped every night and played jazz, bluegrass at a venue and then got on down again. And yeah, whiskey was taken.
That's the way to do it. Another one here, Zaina Akil says, hello and good morning. Thank you so much for the amazing programme. It's been 3 weeks since our dog of 11 years passed. Since then, your podcast has been the only one I've been able to listen to. I have great memories of walking with him whilst listening in fields and woods in our home state of Virginia after we moved to Scotland 2 years ago. I got to listen with him here. This has been a great comfort to me, so thank you for your work. By the way, I'm also a mature student at St Andrews. Oh, that's lovely. Well,
we're
thank
getting
you.
A lot of good comments, aren't we? Yeah. Somebody saying we were good for their mental health.
I know. Well, we try our best. Thank you very much. And Sandy Wilkie says, today the mention of the paddle steamer Waverley brought back memories when I was on board. I bought a postcard from the shop and posted it in the mailbox to my address just to get the Waverley stamp on the card.
Just to say I've been there.
Thanks again for a great friendly show.
No, it'd be great. It'd be nice to do a programme from the Waverley.
Yes.
When we're tied up outside Pacific Quay.
And then off we go to the Kyles of Bute.
Kyles of Bute. It's got a lot of potential there.
Yep.
Now, there's countless songs and tunes associated with particular places in Scotland. And that was the subject of Travelling Folk here on BBC Radio Scotland this week.
Well, I put together a programme with Bruce McGregor, which you can hear on BBC Sounds, looking at this subject in detail. Now, prepare yourself for an earworm, because I've had this song ringing around my head all week. It features a fascinating tale by our researcher Maud Stark, relating to a particular song she grew up with in Findhorn.
There's nothing better in life than sitting round a campfire and singing songs with the people that you love.
The river is flowing and growing. The river is flowing down to the sea.
No matter how pleasant the moment, there are some songs that have a knack of taking you away to a different place or a different point in time. For me, there's no song more powerful than The River is Flowing, a chant that lends itself beautifully to a canon and can easily be picked up by any old numpty round the fire pit after a bit of call and response. My name's Maud Start, and I spent the weekend at the fairy mountain of Shehalion, revisiting the girls that I grew up with at the Findhorn Foundation in the north of Scotland. Part of the childhood package of growing up in the eco-village and community involved learning songs, chants and mantras. The most prominent chant, for me at least, was the one that you hear us singing now.
Down the way, mother of flowing down. Blowing and growing, blowing and growing.
We'd sing it in the morning Tezzy singing practice. We'd sing it in the school playground, and we'd chant it out loud with our faces turned towards the River Findhorn.
Mother, I'll carry me down to the spring.
To me, it was wholly associated with the community, and I've walked through my life teaching people this song, thinking that I was teaching a part of Findhorn. Years later, as a desire to travel beyond the parameters of Findhorn took hold, I found myself in a small Mexican village called Chalmita. The Chalmitans invited me to take part in a temescal, which is a Mayan sweat lodge in the mountains. I was asked to sing a song as part of the ritual, and of course my song choice was The River Is Flowing. After a few verses, I was joined in canon by the others. They were singing the same song in Spanish. How had the song gotten all the way from Findhorn to Chalmita? The coincidence had always shocked me until now, when I've started to do some digging, reaching back to Findhorn to gather the roots to this song. Turns out the chant that I associate with home actually grew out of Native American culture. It was spread around the globe to communities such as Findhorn by way of song carriers who dedicate themselves to sharing music at communities and festivals around the globe. I'm told it was brought to the Findhorn community by a group called Prana, who arrived in 1986 to attend an arts festival. They caused a stir, setting up medicine wheel ceremonies and drum circles after erecting their teepees in the caravan park. It was mayhem, and a powerful week for those living in the community. It's thought that this may have been the way that the song was carried to Moray, and it's been chanted round Scottish fires ever since. Everybody that I've spoken to has a strong association of place linked with the chant.
The river is flowing, flowing and growing. The river is flowing down to the sea.
In many cases, that place is Findhorn, sang in sweat lodges, earth lodges and fire ceremonies to this day. But others associate it with festivals in Australia or rivers in Dusseldorf, women's protests at the Greenham Common in the 80s.
Flowing and growing, the river is growing down to the sea.
The song speaks of a river flowing back to the sea, of the earth as a mother carrying us. The message is pretty universal, and to me it will always remind me of home. As we chant it, somewhat tunelessly, at the foot of the Fairy Mountain, a group of girls now grown up and dispersed, we get lost in the music and the message of the chant.
Mother has carried me down the road. Mother has flown.
It is a mantra with a strong sense of place. But maybe that place is not Findhorn, as I'd first thought. Perhaps that place is around the campfire or on the banks of a river. Perhaps it has no steady postcode at all.
The river is flowing, flowing and growing. The river is flowing back to the sea. Mother, carry me, a child.
Maud, start there and the river is flowing, and take a listen to the latest edition of Travelling Folk here on BBC Radio Scotland with Bruce McGregor for more music relating to place. And you find that on BBC Sounds, and it's very strange, evocative chant.
Yeah, it is. And something that once you've heard it, then it just doesn't leave you. I was gardening yesterday and it was going round and round and round in my head, but that, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's quite a positive.
Like the thought of the... Was it the Song Carriers?
Yes, I'd not heard of that before.
We've heard of storytellers and whatever, Song Carriers going around the world, sharing cultures, and Maud just conjures up a wonderful... You know, she was saying it was chaos, but when all these people arrived with their teepees and their sweatshops and their drums and their... Must have been a real eye opener.
I don't think it was a sweatshop, sweat lodge.
Sweat lodge.
Slightly different concept.
Well spotted.
Yes. So, shall we go over some of these more... whoops. I think I've just revealed
it. That's okay. Well, we're going to do that anyway. So.
Yeah, I'm just going to read some wrong answers first now that I've just revealed that, which is David. Is it one of those ringneck parakeets that have colonised wrong west... Northwest Glasgow parks. We're talking about the mystery bird here, of course. And another one here, Leslie says, is the mystery bird a little grebe? Off to the new allotment to continue the couch grass battle today, then a break in the Black Isle. Got tickets for the Edinburgh Festival yesterday, so semblance of normality return. Also, seen otters in Edinburgh.
Wow.
More than I've ever seen on the coast, she says.
It's incredible, even otters everywhere, apart from near me.
Yep. As I just slightly revealed there, the mystery bird is the moorhen, and I'll read the correct answers and the names of the correct answers after we've listened to this.
The moorhen is a strange beast, and you certainly won't find them on moorland. They hate moorland. Now, the two main common species are found all over the world and look startlingly similar. Yellow legs, a soft, dark black body, a slash of red on its beak, with a yellow tip like the yolk of an egg. And the origins of the colouring are fascinating. In Australia, Aboriginal history tells us that the water hen's leg and beak coloration are due to the result of a long-lasting feud between a water hen and an emu. The story goes that the two birds' nests were very, very close to one another, and they were tight for space. One day, when the moorhen left her eggs for just a few minutes to get something to eat, the emu shifted her nest so that she covered both her eggs and the moorhen's and settled down contentedly. The moorhen was furious and wanted to shift the nest thief. But she was too small to attack the emu directly. And here's where it all got out of hand. The moorhen built a big fire and threw the ashes on her, burning the emu's feathers brown, which they are to this day. The emu screamed and then sprang up in anger and hurled the moorhen into the flames, scorching her legs and beak so that to this day they are the angry red and yellow of fresh burns. Other cultures take a different approach, concentrating on that slash of bright red on the beak. The Aleuna, the burnt forehead, is regarded as a deity in Hawaii, and it was worshipped. One version of the legend is that the bird was the keeper of fire for the gods, until the hero Mao extracted the secret of fire-making from the bird. An alternate version is that the moorhen, taking pity on humanity, stole fire from the gods so that people could keep warm and cook their food. In both versions, the red frontal shield of the bird was due to the scorching by fire. Hawaiians also believed that hearing the cry of the bird at night was an unlucky omen, foretelling death. Now, they may have worshipped them, but not enough to stop them being eaten. Captured by being run down or by stone throwing, the flesh is supposedly tasty, though gamey and tough. One UK recipe suggests put two moorhens, carrots, onions, leek potatoes and other veg, plus a 6-inch rusty nail in a large pot with plenty of stock. Cook for 5 hours, remove the birds and throw them away and eat the rusty nail. They are, of course, now protected. It's been known as the moorhen from Saxon times, or the moorhen, meaning marsh. a real bird of water. And if threatened, the chicks will latch onto the parent's back and off she'll fly to safety with the chicks hanging on. The collective of water hens is a plump. And that orange-red bill with a bright yellow tip is actually coded so that other moor hens can tell how healthy an individual is, much like flamingos. Scientists have shown that the different colours on the bird's bill are actually health indicators. The red seems to be related to low levels of bacterial infection, and the yellow to blood parameters such as resistance to infection. The brighter the colours, the more attractive the bird is deemed. And finally, and this is a clincher about the sophistication, the intelligence and the charm of the water hen. For the discerning female moorhen, the preferred mate is a small, fat male. The moorhen, what an intelligent bird.
Okay.
Glossing over that.
The rusty nail, that was amusing. I'm going to read out some correct answers here. Ruth in Dalbeattie says, ever since I discovered that moorhens used to be called meerhens, which makes more sense for a water bird, I use that name. John and Lewis in Rothie Norman, good morning again. Second guess, is it a moorhen? Resigned to yet another inglorious failure. Well, you're not failing. It gives our friends who listen hours of amusement. Liz in Edinburgh, she says it's a moorhen. Think I heard one 2 days ago on Inverleith Pond. And Sandy Johnson got it right. Vary and Kyle in Oxford. And Sandy Faye Dunlugas.
Andrew Barry at Roman Camp in Roxburn got it right. It's his second guess, a moorhen. Alan Virtue in Canvas Barron. Good morning, both. We're texting from a holiday in a dull and breezy Loch Inver, where we'll be walking and I will be trout fishing. Pretty sure your mystery bird is a moorhen. Julian in Ludlow says, I think it's a moorhen. Thanks for a great show and podcast. I've pointed out to many friends in your direction to accompany them during lockdown exercise. Other folk that got it right. James in Stonehaven, Paddy in Aberdeen, Wendy in Montrose, Susie from Spot, Anne in Lanark and Shirley in Ayr.
Well done everyone who got it right. You can walk proud today. Sal Buckler and Bill Strang got in touch at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. We always listen to your programme, not always live, usually on BBC Sounds, but today we're actually listening live at Holt Whistle while walking Hadrian's Wall. Yesterday we visited the amazing Vindolanda Roman Fort. Highly recommended. Thanks for your great programme. Isn't it lovely that people are actually getting out and about and doing stuff now?
I mean, the weather is just so inspirational. Folk are actually getting out and going the Waverley and go and walk Hadrian's Wall.
It's lovely, yeah. And another one here, Dennis from Bucksburn says, when we were running a scuba diving club in Aberdeen, we'd often go to the Lynn of Dee for a dive when the North Sea was too stormy. As a freshwater dive, it is most interesting at 7 to 8 metres depth and often full of salmon and eels, although with big rock overhangs, it's a real challenge for the swimmer.
It's scary as well.
It is a bit scary, but what a spot.
Yeah, if you get it right, it's brilliant. Andrew Tate says, water dowsing. Enjoying the show as ever. I used to live in an old cottage above Tarland that looked over the stone circle in the distance. It was an old house that we bought off the estate. We didn't know where the water supply came in and off the hill or where the soakaway was. We found it both easily using dowsing rods. That's Andrew Tate in Kendal. So obviously works, doesn't it? Fantastic. Now, on last week's programme, we ran a piece that Mark had recorded in Oban featuring a cuckoo. And at the time, we commented that it's very much that kind of West Coast sound. Well, later in the afternoon, deep in rural Bampshire, I thought I heard one. It's a really, really rare sound here. I tried 3 times to record it and finally nailed it. A cuckoo in my woods. And as I sat there glowing in my prowess at wildlife recording in the quiet of the Scottish countryside, let's say the gloss was taken off the moment. Have a listen. You've got no idea how angry I was.
Did the cuckoo set off the alarm?
I think the cuckoo might have set off the alarm, but the cuckoo just legged it and was never seen again.
Oh, that's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's such a lovely sound. It was just so great to hear it.
Yeah.
Although my neighbour thought I had a big speaker and was playing a cuckoo sound just to confuse him.
Because they couldn't believe it was actually true.
Oh, because we both could hear it and nobody believed the other one, so it was quite fascinating.
Oh well, such an evocative sound of summer. It might be time for you just to remind us about cuckoo facts. They change their call, don't they?
Yeah, but right about now it goes from cuckoo to cuckoo. Now, that's almost it for this week. Don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast at noon today. And look out for the Midweek Post podcast, which this week features Fair Isle-born musician Inga Thompson. Thank you very much for listening.